This is Wade Rathke. It's Wade's World. That means it's Friday morning wherever you are. It's 9 to 9:30 Central Time and time across the globe. We're on 88.3 broadcasting live from the studio in Little Rock, Arkansas, and then picked up in Dallas, Flagstaff, Seattle, you name it around the country. We're available on web streaming at www.kabf.org and on a podcast by Monday, so that anybody who misses any part of Wade's World can hear it then and share it with friends and family and people who need to know. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Jasmine Heiss, who is a senior campaigner with Amnesty International United States. Jasmine's been involved in a lot of issues about individuals caught up against just incredibly oppressive prison conditions. Jasmine, you and I first met. Welcome to Wade's World, I should say.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Well, I'm so glad I grabbed you. I couldn't not grab you. I missed you when you were in New Orleans recently, but coming back to town from Little Rock, I read an article quoting you about this case you have been on like a dog on a bone. Tell us a little bit about Albert Wood Fox and the terrors of Angola Prison in New Orleans. In Louisiana.
In Louisiana, yes. Well, Albert Wood Fox, his name has gained some notoriety because he is the longest-serving prisoner in solitary confinement in the United States. He has been in isolation on and off for most of four decades since a prison guard was murdered at Louisiana State Penitentiary, also known as Angola, in 1972. For all of that time, Albert has been fighting to prove his innocence in a legal process just absolutely riddled with flaws. His conviction has now been overturned three times, and he maintains that he was first put into solitary confinement for his work as an activist inside the prison, not for the murder that he's convicted of. He and other prisoners formed the first Black Panther Party chapter inside a prison, and they were organizing against things like sexual slavery, like segregation. As you probably know, and some of your listeners, at that time, Angola was one of the most violent prisons, if not the most violent prison in the United States. So today, 43 years later, Albert remains trapped in a cell the size of a parking space and fighting to prove his innocence. There's no physical evidence that ties him to the crime. The key eyewitness that the state used to convict him was eventually given a pardon, despite the fact that he was a serial rapist. And there are really outrageous statements, including by the current warden of Angola Prison, about the reasons for his isolation, specifically referencing Albert's role as a Black Panther.
Oh, we'll talk about that. But look, this is crazy. You're telling me he's been three times, courts have ruled that he shouldn't be there, but he's still there, isn't he?
He is. And most recently, he was actually granted an unconditional writ of release from Judge Brady, who said that the state should no longer be allowed to retry him after all of this time. Despite that, the state appealed, as they have at every other point in this case, and Albert remains behind bars, while the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals weighs whether or not Judge Brady's ruling can stand. Meanwhile, even as one court is considering whether or not Albert can be retried, he's already been reindicted, and he's set to begin trial in state court later this month on the 21st.
Now, is Judge Brady a federal or a state judge?
Judge Brady is a federal judge, and he's been reindicted in state court. And so one of our major questions as we look at this case and see the number of sheer resources that are going toward it from the Attorney General's office is, why is the Louisiana Attorney General so committed to keeping this man behind bars when there is all of this compelling proof, not only of innocence, but of really grave miscarriages of justice by the Louisiana authorities?
And not only did they keep him in prison, but I'm gathering you're saying he's still in solitary confinement.
He is. He's in a parish prison near Angola Prison as he awaits trial in state court, in a cell that's roughly 6 by 9 feet, where he's spent more than half of his life at this point. He has a solid door in front of him and little meaningful human contact. This is a grave human rights abuse. As Amnesty International, we look at both civil rights abuses and other issues with the human rights framework. And Albert's conditions have actually specifically been called by United Nations experts torture. They've been defined as torture. Yet he remains there, and the United States has more than 80,000 people in similar conditions in isolation in this country on any given day.
Well, I know recently, and I don't want to go off of the Wood Fox case, but California seems to have settled a huge case that seems to mean that they're going to release significant numbers of people from any kind of solitary confinement in that state.
Absolutely. California took a huge step forward with the recent settlement, which will see just countless people who have been trapped in this nightmare released from these cells. That victory, I would say, is a testament really to the endurance and to the bravery of the prisoners themselves and of their families. But I think the last time so much media attention was turned toward California were during the hunger strikes, when many of the prisoners in isolated confinement were striking to protest their conditions. And I think that advocates and prisoners alike really see that victory in California as directly tied to those courageous actions.
Most people listening, and, you know, none of us are exempt from this, when we hear, you know, hunger strikes or Amnesty International, we think about Guantanamo Bay, or we think about, you know, terrible conditions in China or, you know, some other place in the world. We don't necessarily think about the United States of America. But how did Amnesty International get involved in this issue with Angola and Wood Fox?
Well, Amnesty International has, for a very long time, worked on the United States and on conditions around the world. We talk a lot about what it means to bring human rights home here in the United States, to apply the human rights framework here, and similarly to understand how the issues here at home in the United States both connect to and can be acted upon in the global sphere using international human rights mechanisms. When we look at the United States, we see a growing crisis with the use of solitary confinement, a practice that is continuing, but in many ways unchecked in the shadows of our criminal justice system. While there are some states, like most recently California, that have taken steps forward, there are no national regulations or guidelines or really any need or mandate to keep meaningful data on the way that solitary confinement is being used, on the appropriate checks and balances, on who is in isolation. And so when we look at this human rights crisis, we always try to lift up examples of individual cases, which is really my job at Amnesty, to understand how these human rights issues crystallize into lived realities for people in the United States and around the world. And so when we look at Albert Wood Fox's case, we see really one of the most egregious examples of prolonged solitary confinement in our country. And beyond that, a case where other issues that plague our criminal justice system in the United States, like systemic racism, like economic inequality, also play a very large role. And so in many ways, this is emblematic of not only the work that Amnesty does, but of the way that we need to advance as a country and take a step forward toward justice.
We're talking to Jasmine Heiss, who's a senior campaigner with Amnesty USA. Jasmine, you were in the Times-Picayune and the New Orleans newspaper, the occasional paper, that you participated. You listened in on a hearing last week. What was that hearing about on the Wood Fox case?
Last week, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the federal appeals court in New Orleans, was considering the ruling that I mentioned earlier, Judge Brady's writ of unconditional release. So a three-judge panel is hearing arguments from both the state and from Albert's defense team about whether or not this ruling should stand. There were arguments advanced by both sides, compellingly, you know, reiterating the grave concerns expressed by Judge Brady about the fact that the state has been unable to provide a fair trial for Mr. Wood Fox, even after two tries, and even so are set to retry him in state court for a third time. Also noting the extreme prejudice done to Albert Wood Fox by 43 years of solitary confinement.
So that was a bizarre experience, I'm sure.
I would say, looking at the very tangled legal history of this case, it's all sort of bizarre in a way, given that his conviction, again, has been overturned three times, that he has been granted a writ of unconditional release. And then, now as we look forward toward this trial in state court, many of the key witnesses for both the defense and the prosecution are no longer living. And so there is, I think, a pending question that remains to be answered of how the state will guarantee a fair trial, of how we will be able to understand a full and compelling picture of the case from both sides with these key voices unable to testify, and again, of why the Attorney General's office is so zealously pursuing this case despite all of these obstacles and concerns.
The same Times Picayune article caught my attention because after I saw your quote a little bit later, it quoted the warden at Angola Prison, Burl Kane, giving his defense for why he still had Wood Fox, and he had some euphemism, self-containment, you know, whatever, solitary confinement. And he said that they just really had to stop this Black Pantherism, that he wouldn't allow Ku Klux Klanner organize in his prison, and he wouldn't allow Black Panthers. You know, Black Panthers have really been pretty much out of existence since the mid, I mean, we're talking 40 years, almost as long as Wood Fox has been in prison. But Warden Kane just seemed to think this is an everyday problem. He's got his finger in the dike and has got to stop it at any turn. So he can't, that's his rationale for not allowing Wood Fox to be in general population, as he calls it. This is just, it's sort of so dialed back. It's like a catch-22, another reality. I mean, talk about not being around. I don't think there are any Black Panthers really around.
I think that in a way, Burl Kane's explanation of the case perhaps shines light onto some of these questions I've been asking. Why are the state authorities so determined to keep Albert Woodfox behind bars? On a previous occasion, Burl Kane said, I would not want him walking around my prison because he would organize the young new inmates. I would have more problems than I could stand, and I would have the Blacks chasing after them. I would have chaos and conflict. I believe that. And so when the Attorney General, for example, decides that he is going to say that the reason Albert has to remain in solitary confinement and has to remain behind bars is because he is a dangerous man, you then have the warden of the prison where Albert was first placed in isolation saying, no, it's because he's organizing. It's because he's a Black Panther. It's because he will start organizing other Black inmates. And it provides, I think, a little bit more insight into the mentality, perhaps, of some of the state authorities in keeping Albert behind bars. He has had a clean disciplinary record for decades. There's no compelling reason to keep him in isolation. And so then we have to ask again, is the reason for his continued confinement, for living four decades of a nightmare, really because of racial discrimination and because of racially based fear on the part of the authorities? And, you know, only the Attorney General and the warden themselves can answer that, but it seems that Burl Kane has made his feelings abundantly clear.
Oh, I think they have answered. I mean, we're fairly used to around this country reading all kinds of rationales for why somebody is stepped in prison, particularly solitary. And we're not hearing all about, you know, whoever prison guard or whatever was allegedly killed by Wood Fox. All we're hearing about is Black Pantherism. So I think it's pretty clear what this is about. This is not the only thing you do, though, is it, Jasmine? You mentioned you also are involved in some international cases.
I am. So my role as a senior campaigner for individuals at risk means that I look at the full spectrum of Amnesty International's work through the lens of individual cases and individual stories. And so the other case that I am working on very closely right now is a very different part of the world, but again, a prisoner who has been, we believe, unjustly imprisoned, and we are calling for his release. It's the case of Raif Badawi, who is a Saudi Arabian blogger who was imprisoned for 10 years and sentenced to 1,000 lashes for a blog that he ran called Saudi Arabian Liberals. On this blog, he discussed issues of liberalism, of religion, of the relationship between the two. And because of that, he has been charged with violating really draconian information technology laws in Saudi Arabia. And his family is living in exile in Canada.
How do you survive 1,000 lashes? I mean, I'm amazed he's alive.
I think that there's a double question there. How does one survive 10 years in a Saudi Arabian prison?
Oh, God. I was going to go to that next.
Lashes. certainly. Well, he's been given the lashings that he's meted out at 10 lashes at a time. He has been flogged publicly once. The case captured a lot of global attention at that moment, and there really was an immediate global outcry and response, in part because there was a video leaked, despite the fact that it's illegal to film public floggings in Saudi Arabia. There was a video leaked, and so the world really saw the brutality that Raif Badawi has been subject to in Saudi Arabia. We believe that that immediate response, the grassroots activism, and the outcry of several governments across the world has helped postpone, if not stop, subsequent lashings. But we continue to call for his release. It's imperative that now that this global outcry has subsided without additional floggings, that he not just be allowed to languish in the shadows of the Saudi prison.
You know, I've written an almost daily blog for a dozen years. And the notion, you know, you write them, you put them up, they get posted, and away you go. These are not things that you think about for days and years before you write them. The notion that you could go to prison for a blog period, or if you go to prison for 10 years, or to go to prison and get 1,000 less. I mean, this is just like, wow. I mean, now is he in solitary, or do people get to visit him? I mean, do people know his condition?
It's very difficult for us to know his condition, in part because Amnesty is not allowed into the country. We are in close touch with his wife, Ansef Khadr, who will be coming to Washington, D.C. next week to meet with high-level members of the State Department, of Congress, and others to speak about his case. But it's very difficult to know exactly what's happening to him. Again, just as we talked about Albert Woodfox's case being part of this larger landscape around race and criminalization in the U.S. justice system, Raif Badawi's case can only really be understood within the context of a much larger crackdown on human rights and on freedom of expression in Saudi Arabia. His conviction stems from articles that he wrote, which in many ways are very innocuous discussions of things like religion and freedom of expression. But the Saudi Arabian authorities really have a widespread campaign to persecute civil society activists and human rights defenders, and they're doing it with almost complete impunity. The United States and Saudi Arabia, as you know, have an important strategic relationship, or so-called strategic relationship, that involves really billions of dollars in arms and in oil money. And the United States so far has failed to really put human rights at the center of their relationship with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and to press for the release of prisoners of conscience, like Raif Badawi. In fact, Raif's brother-in-law, who's also his lawyer, Waleed Abu Al-Khair, is one of the most well-known human rights defenders in the country, and he's also in prison. He was one of the first people to be imprisoned in a special terrorism court that Saudi Arabia has set up, and the United States has not spoken out widely about that case, which is really, I think, a shame and a stain on our country's reputation.
How does he act as his brother's lawyer when he's also in prison? And now I've got to also ask, if he's one of the best well-known human rights lawyers in Saudi Arabia, how is this not all combined in what's happening to both the lawyer and the blogger?
Well, for us, it absolutely is combined. We'll be elevating Waleed's case in our upcoming Right for Rights campaign, which looks at emblematic cases of human rights defenders, prisoners of conscience, torture survivors, and others around the world. We are in touch with the families, and we really seek to uplift both of those cases. I would say, you know, it's impossible for him to represent Raif while they're both in prison. And that really speaks to the just sort of fractured nature of rule of law in Saudi Arabia when someone can be tried in a terrorism court for their work as a human rights defender, for their work as a lawyer, when someone can be put in prison for writing very simply about the relationship between a faith-based society and freedom of expression and liberalism. And so I think that when you look at that, when you look at those lack of basic checks on rule of law, it becomes imperative that the global community step up, speak out, and hold these authorities to account and call for the release of people like Raif, like Waleed, and here in the United States, like Albert, because without the voices of an engaged grassroots human rights community, then there are no political costs and there are no reasons for these powerful people to secure the release of prisoners across the world.
We're talking to Jasmine Heiss, who's a senior campaigner for Amnesty International in the U.S. Obviously, if Amnesty is barred from Saudi Arabia, you haven't been there, so your work as an organizer in this campaign is challenged as well. So what can people do to help?
Well, there's many things that people can do to help. Right now, to see the full breadth of Amnesty's work, you can go to amnestyusa.org. To take immediate action on the cases that I've mentioned, to immediately send an appeal to the Louisiana authorities on Albert Woodfox's behalf, folks can go to amnestyusa.org/Angola3. And then to take action on behalf of Raif Badawi, the Saudi Arabian blogger, again, folks can go to amnestyusa.org/FreeRaif. That's FreeRaif. And I would just, you know, in many ways we think of the world, we look out at all of the horrible things happening every day, global atrocities, injustices, and it really confounds the moral imagination. It can become overwhelming. But we know that when people speak out together, when our billion-person-wide global community, our millions of Amnesty supporters, speak with one voice on behalf of prisoners of conscience and human rights defenders, we can have an impact. We can quite literally change people's lives. So I would encourage people to go to take action and to become engaged, because you can be the voice that helps change the world.
I'm going to have you repeat those websites again before we end the show, but how long have you been doing this? Because this must be a frustrating job in some ways.
I have been with Amnesty for about 3.5 years. There are many days, you are right, that I wake up and I think we are working against forces that are too big to possibly be overcome. But in many ways, as with everyone in this movement and in this work, I am standing on the shoulders of giants, of people like Robert King and Malik Rahim in Louisiana, who were some of the earliest advocates for Albert Woodfox. Robert King was one of the Angola Three, the first freed member, and today is their most tireless advocate. We're working side by side with people like Ensaf Haidar, the wife of Raif Badawi, who has traveled the world to shine a light on her husband's case. And so even in those moments of despair or frustration, you just look around the world. I look around the world and see people who are getting up and who are committed to fighting for human rights every day, and it is really an honor. It's humbling to be part of that community.
I have no doubt, but you also must have your antenna up for where we may see problems like this starting to emerge elsewhere. Are there areas that you were worried about that the sort of oppressive criminal injustice systems may be coming to the same kinds of problems we're talking about in the Woodfox case or the Saudi Arabia incident?
I think that one of the things that I have colleagues working on that I find perhaps the most compelling and the most troubling, very closely connected to Albert Woodfox's case, is the surveillance of communities here in the United States, both activists, Muslim communities, and the way in which that is really proceeding unchecked in many ways, both by police departments and others. I think beyond that, you know, we really are confronting a crisis of mass incarceration in this country. And so we're looking at Amnesty at some of those drivers of mass incarceration and trying to understand what are the things that need to be put in place to address those, looking at things like immigration detention and excessively high bail being imposed, debtors' prisons, all of those issues. I would say that my sort of laundry list of problems that we see across the country and around the world could be endless, but those are some of the things that I really see coming to a head. And also, I think now is the moment for those issues. We really feel the fierce urgency of now. Now is the time to step up and do what we can to change some of those oppressive systems.
Well, I think that's an excellent point. I mean, when you read that even Ferguson, Missouri, obviated more than 1,000 cases that were pending on, you know, these crazy charges. Debtors' prison is really the most accurate word when you start essentially holding low-income people And I guess there was this recent cell phone footage that came out of a Georgia judge trying to shake down poor people to get, you know, $500 here, $300 here, or go to jail if they didn't come up with some noxious amount of money to deal with some ridiculous kind of traffic violation, regardless of the United States Supreme Court saying, hey, you can't do that. If somebody doesn't have the money to pay, you can't hold them in jail. But that's... It may not be mass incarceration, as you're saying, Jasmine, but it's incarceration, and it's happening in enough places and enough particularly urban areas in the country. It almost is mass incarceration now, isn't it?
Certainly. I think when we look at it, again, it contributes to the sheer number of people who are being held in prisons in this country. The United States is the world's lead incarcerator, and then you look at a country or a state, rather, like Louisiana, which has the highest rates of incarceration in the United States, and in many ways outstrips some of those classic human rights abusers that you think of, like China and Iran, in terms of the sheer number of people in prison related to the overall population. And so when we think about things like criminal justice and criminal justice reform in the United States, and you think about issues like the incarceration of poor people and the high rates of incarceration of people of color, it's clear that we're not just talking about criminal justice issues. We're also talking about economic and racial justice issues in this country.
There's no question. And your work and obviously the work of many people, and it's encouraging to see the Black Lives Matter movement starting to build. And so, yeah, even the president has done some of the right things here in terms of decriminalizing some offenses or moving in that direction and the federal system. There's starting to be a little bit of hope on the horizon. So we have to, you know, keep rooting, keep involved, and keep rooting for your work and many others to keep this issue in front of people until we get real change. Jasmine, we're coming to the end of this over the next minute or two, so I'm going to ask you for some final thoughts about what people listening to this show might be able to do and how they can send any kind of signed petition, send a couple of dollars your way, or whatever it is that makes helps make this thing go.
Absolutely. I would say, again, the first place that people should go to see all of Amnesty's work and to understand all of the ways in which they can become engaged is amnestyusa.org. To take action on Albert Woodfox's case, go to amnestyusa.org/Angola3. And to take action on behalf of imprisoned Saudi Arabian blogger Raif Badawi, amnestyusa.org/freeraif, F-R-E-E-R-A-I-F. I would also encourage people to check out our annual Right for Rights campaign, which again, as I said, is a campaign that we have on behalf of prisoners of conscience, human rights defenders, and torture survivors all over the world. It happens around Human Rights Day on December 10th, and it's the world's largest grassroots human rights event. So if people want to learn more about that, they can go to right.amnestyusa.org and become involved in this year's campaign.
December 10th is Human Rights Day. Now, that's something a lot of us don't realize, but I'm going to write that down, put it on the calendar. We might have to track you down somewhere. Hopefully, I won't interrupt a holiday, and I'll catch you in your office. Maybe talk about that again in a couple of months. But we've been talking today on Wade's World to Jasmine Heiss, who is a senior campaigner for Amnesty International in the United States. She's told people how to get in touch. It's AmnestyUSA.org, and then there's a number of branches you can follow off of that tree to get involved, do what's right, send them some help, and in the meantime, keep this issue in front of you. Wade's World, we're going to be talking to some other people next week. We've been on www.kbf.org, a podcast of this show, and I have to thank Jasmine. I don't think we've ever had anybody as articulate for their issue ever on Wade's World as Jasmine was. So she's been a heck of a representative for Amnesty International in this cause. So it's been a pleasure. We'll see you next Friday. Well, our delight. This has been KABF 88.3, 100,000 watts of people power, the voice of the people, broadcast from Little Rock, Arkansas, heard around the world, and rebroadcast in stations several places in the United States. We'll see you next Friday on